uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, peace, justice, truth, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on Thomas Jefferson's birthday. Somehow I just don't think we're going to hear a lot about this in the media, but to me it's an important day. You know, they've combined it with Washington's birthday and called it President's Day. Well, actually, I think it was Lincoln's that got combined with Washington's. But on the 13th of April, 1743, in Shadwell, Virginia, Thomas Jefferson was born. And here's a great little bio from Hutu.com. A biographer, James Parton, said Thomas Jefferson could, quote, calculate an eclipse, survey an estate, tie an artery, plan an edifice, try a cause, break a horse, dance a minuet, and play the violin. Not to mention serving as U.S. president from 1801 to 1809, vice president, secretary of state, minister to France, member of Congress, governor of Virginia, founder of the University of Virginia. By the way, that was one of the things that he was most proud of, was the fact that he had created free public education for anybody in the state of Virginia who, any person, regardless of their ability to pay. He believed that free public education, all the way up to, PhD actually wasn't invented at that point. The PhD, the Doctor of Philosophy degree, was invented by Fichte, the German philosopher, in around 1809. But in any case, all the way up to whatever the highest level of education would be possible, Jefferson felt that that was a cornerstone of democracy. That was a cornerstone of freedom. It was absolutely necessary. And thus, he created the University of Virginia, free education. And it's Ronald Reagan who took apart the University of California, one of the last of the free university systems in the United States. Of course, Reagan, well, you've heard that rant before. And at the beginning of the end of Jeffersonian democracy in America, he was also the president and founder of the American Philosophical Society. For all of that, Jefferson is best remembered as a champion of human rights. And I tell you, he would be tearing up right now, looking at what has been happening with Abu Ghraib, and to learn that his country is now engaging in an extraordinary rendition, putting people on flights to nations that practice torture, specifically to torture them, when we know, when our own intelligence service says, no, wait a minute, you're not going to get good information from torture. You're going to get stupid information on which we're going to make stupid decisions like we did to invading Iraq. I mean, you're going to end up with the wrong stuff. There are more effective ways to get information out of people. But, you know, Bush is like, you know, there's a few people in the administration who are just, you know, really into this whole idea of, you know, we're macho, you know, going to take these guys on. It's really, I think, a testimonial to excessive or perhaps deficient testosterone rather than anything else. Anyhow, today's Jefferson's birthday. The one thing that I think that is worth remembering, one of many, of course, of Jefferson on Jefferson's birthday, in the Declaration of Independence, which he authored, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands, which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitled them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Well, that third part, that decent respect part, that's John Kerry's global test that George W. Bush likes to make fun of. But before that, the laws of nature and nature's God. Thomas Jefferson absolutely believed that the democracy was the way of nature, that it was burned into us. John Adams wrote a letter to John Taylor just a few years before Adams died. Well, Adams and Jefferson died the same day, same time, within an hour or so of each other. Anyhow, John Adams, who was the then equivalent of what today would be a Republican, a Federalist. He wrote, "Remember, democracy never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There never was a democracy yet that did not commit suicide." So that was the Federalist point of view. That was the aristocratic point of view. That was the, this democracy is a nice idea, but, we really want. Jefferson, on the other hand, believed in the essential wisdom of democracy. In 1816, he wrote a letter to Samuel Kercheval on September 5th. In which he made this note. He said, "The article nearest my heart is the division of counties into wards." You say what? Counties into wards? He says, "Yes. These will be pure and elementary republics. The sum of all which, taken together, composes the state, and will make of the whole a true democracy." And it's what he's saying is what I have been saying on this program for 2 years now. Get active locally. Get active in local politics. And as Jefferson said, that's what's necessary for a true democracy. And in fact, now science has borne this out. I mean, Jefferson went so far in some of his writings as to say that he believed that animals and plants behave democratically. Whereas conventional wisdom at the time, and really Darwin kind of reinforced this, although you can find some ambiguity and some ambivalence in Darwin's writings. But nonetheless, from the time of Jefferson, well, for thousands of years before that, in fact, all the way through the time of Jefferson, right up until a couple of years ago, everybody believed that, democracy is a nice idea and let's do it and it's great for humans. But it requires, we have to force ourselves to do it because it's not human nature. Human nature is to be hierarchical and patriarchal and dominant and all that kind of stuff. And Jefferson, way back in 1776, said, no. That's not how nature and nature's God would have it. And then Tim Conrad and Tim Roper and L. Conrad at the School of Biological Sciences, the University of Sussex in England, they said, let's check this thing out. And this is a paper that was published in the January 9th, 2003 issue of the journal Nature, right? A top-of-the-line science journal. And they discovered that democracy always trumps despotism. Despotism being a strong leader making the decisions for the group. In every animal category that you could look at, democracy always beats despotism, both over the short term and the long term. They pointed out in this article that when a single leader, what they referred to as a despot, or a small group of leaders, which they referred to as an oligarchy, makes the choices, the swings into extremes of behavior tend to be greater and more dangerous to the long-term survival of the group. With democratic decision making, however, the overall knowledge and wisdom of the entire group, as well as the needs of the entire group, come into play. The outcome is less likely to harm anybody, and the group's probability of survival is enhanced. As they say, and I'm quoting from their study, democratic decisions are more beneficial primarily because they tend to produce less extreme decisions. And you look around at these new oligarchs that we have now here in Washington, D.C., the Republican Party, a new oligarchy. It's the small ruling family, right? It's the new kingdom. And you see what? Extremism in their behavior. It's just right there. And Jefferson says that, no, this is not how it should be. It should be the will of the majority of the people. And he said, not only that, this is how it's always been. Moral precepts against killing and stealing are found not only in the Bible, but exist among every tribe on earth, some whose cultures and languages go back over 60,000 years. And Jefferson pointed this out. He said, we're not basing this country on any particular religion or anything. He says, this is nature. On June 5th, in 1824, he wrote a letter to Major John Cartwright, in which he said, and I quote, "Our revolution commenced on more favorable ground than the foundation of English or biblical law. It presented us an album on which we were free to write what we pleased. We had no occasion to search into musty records, to hunt up royal parchments, or to investigate the laws and institutions of a semi-barbarous ancestry. We appealed to those of nature and found them engraved on our arts. End of quote. So, there you go. Our Thomas Jefferson moment. By the way, Louise and I now in Portland, Oregon, official residence yesterday, bought a floating house, a house that's sitting on these kind of, well, floats. it's in the Willamette River, and with geese on the back deck, and we've got to be careful, I guess. So we've been warned by our neighbors, if they lay their eggs there, then they won't let us out. And so, it's a hoot. It's a real hoot. We're going to move the cats over there this afternoon after I get off the air. I'll bring you up to date on how that goes, how they handle. When we were out there over the weekend, we saw a sea lion catch a salmon in the river. And this great big sea lion just going down the river, catch a salmon and chewing the thing down. It's incredible. So it's the wonders of the water world out here. I told Louise the other day, she said, "Oh, it's raining again." And I said, no, you have to notice when the sun comes out, because that's the exception to the rule. Anyhow, back to democracy. Wisconsin is going to join a lawsuit against the Bush administration. Governor Jim Doyle of Wisconsin announced this week. He said, "Wisconsin is a leader in controlling mercury emissions, but unfortunately, we can't stop mercury from other states from polluting our waters. It's time for the Bush administration to follow the Clean Air Act." Now, this is the governor of the state of Wisconsin saying this, that it's time for the Bush administration to follow the law. An article in the Daily Cardinal, a Wisconsin newspaper, by Michael Warringer, says, "Doyle is concerned the Environmental Protection Agency has proposed rules that call..." See, these are the EPA's new rules that will cut back that will cut back the current laws and make it easier for power plants to pollute. They call for only a 21% reduction in mercury emissions by 2010 and is allowing 19 states to increase their emissions until then. This is, this is like the new version of Clear Skies Act, because the Clear Skies Act, which did the same thing, got shot down. It wasn't going to make it through the Senate because it was just so corrupt. Bush just says to the head of the EPA, "Well, just do it." And so they're doing it. Every freshwater body in the state of Wisconsin is under a mercury advisory right now. Every single one. And the Bush administration is saying to the governor and to the people of Wisconsin, what are you worried about? In fact, Senator Neil Kedzie, a Republican of Elkhorn, this state senator, a Republican, of course, chairs the Committee on Natural Resources and Transportation. He says, "I'm somewhat disappointed that the governor wants to get involved at the federal level. This lawsuit sets a negative tone." Yeah. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Bosses of the world, unite. Let us save the day.
We need the bosses.
Contents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay.
Oh, we can't have that.
We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard, and we too sometimes need to paint our home.
Yes. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Is democracy natural? Yes, I think so. A few other questions we're going to be looking at today. Is it possible to fool Mother Nature? This is an incredible one. You ever heard of Klebsiella planticola? Well, we'll get to that. Are we trading in democracy for aristocracy? It's kind of the theme for the day. Our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894. The website, TomHartman.com, however you spell it, will get you there. Click Live Chat up at the top of the page. It'll get you into it'll get you to the message board, then click Live Chat again, and that'll get you into the live chat room, which is already well populated. I got to say, Diesel Creek in the chat room, he says, "Well, Tom, geese on the back deck. We don't have a lawn to mow, or anything. It's like water around us. I mean, this thing is literally out in the river. We got to cross a bridge to get, you know, over about 100, 200 feet of river to get out to the dock. And but in any case, he says you got the geese are cool because you've got eggs for breakfast and you know, actually, Diesel Creek, I got to tell you, these geese will hunt you down. You've got a goose sitting on eggs, and I guess it's the goose and the gander, right? The gander is the gander will come after you. They will chase you down the street. These are big animals. And he says, you know, you're going to have to worry about the cats going after them. No, you have to worry about them eating the cats, I think, is the problem. And wait until Higgins sees a sea lion. That's going to be pretty wild. Anyhow, airborne pesticides drifting from farm spraying. Today's USA Today, the new battles. Part of this is the fact that there's a growing awareness in America of pesticides and the significance of it, and this has like always been kind of an issue that going back to the Cesar Chavez days, you know, the farm workers, was it Farm Workers Alliance, as I recall, the farm workers union, the original farm workers union with the grape boycott and all that back in the 60s or 70s. Going all the way back to then, people were talking about the pesticide exposure of migrant farm workers, but everybody kind of figured, these are migrant farm workers, and that's they don't, you know, they're not voting. It's not a political bloc. We don't have to worry about them. Blah, blah, blah. Well, I mean, they're people, right? But they didn't have much political power. And what is happening now is the suburbs are growing into agricultural areas as the population of the country grows, and the agricultural areas, they're still spraying pesticides like crazy, and now you're having battles between suburban soccer moms and dads who do vote and who do know how to write letters to their member of Congress about the pesticides that are floating over onto into their neighborhoods and the birth defects that their children are experiencing and the toxic effects of these things. Lawsuits actually coming out now. The USA Today points out this about a lawsuit in California. They said national groups such as the Natural Resources Defense Council charge in 8 other lawsuits here and in Seattle, Baltimore, and other cities that the Environmental Protection Agency has failed to regulate pesticides as required by the 1998 Food Quality. What? The Bush administration's EPA is failing to regulate something like pesticides manufactured by one of the toxic industries? I am shocked! Shocked, I tell you! The lawsuits come as competition from overseas growers, rising energy costs, and consumer demand for flawless produce are squeezing farmers. I got to tell you, you know, I prefer to shop in the co-op, and I prefer to buy the apples that have the blemishes on them. You know, if I see something that looks like a bird pecked it or a worm might have tried to chew into it or something like that, I can cut that off or eat around it. I know I'm not chewing poison, and I think an increasing number of people are thinking that way. Anyhow, we've got cloned beef on the menu. And I got to tell you about Klebsiella planticola right after this. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Your home for Democracy on the Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Will you come down from your ivory tower?
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, What Thinking People Do for Fun. Clones beef and milk the same as regular? This in today's USA Today, but it was all over. I mean, it was in the news last night. Probably everybody in America has heard this. There's no difference between meat and milk from cloned livestock and those foods obtained from conventionally bred cattle, according to a study released today. Writes Elizabeth Weiss in USA Today. Today. However, I mean, this is like the big study, right? That's validating the safety of genetically altered, or not genetically altered, cloned beef and milk. However, only 2 beef cattle were slaughtered for testing because such animals are rare, notes USA Today. cost $20,000 to create. They cost too much to destroy. There is, at this moment, by the way, no law. No federal laws, no state laws, no, as far as I know, no local or county, no laws regulating eating food, putting into the food supply, whatever, things where, you know, people have tried to play with Mother Nature. None. Scientists announced this week, by the way, the creation of dairy cows genetically engineered to resist mastitis. That's an infection that cows' udders. Basically mastitis is caused by turning cows into machines, by hooking them up to these milking things that are sucking on them constantly at very high pressure, and it busts open their udders and they get infections loses the dairy industry $2 billion a year. It's one of the reasons they've got to shoot them up with antibiotics. So they're going to breed cows that are resistant to mastitis. But what's that, you know, by genetically modifying them, what's that going to do for us? What's that going to do for people who, well, I shouldn't say us. I don't eat beef. But, I do eat cheese, so there you go. What's that going to, well, there's a little story here. This doesn't exactly translate, but it's kind of in the realm of, is it a good thing to mess with Mother Nature? Is it a reasonable thing to fool with Mother Nature? And by the way, yes, we will get to Tom DeLay eventually today. But I think this is really amazing. There is a bacteria that is absolutely ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's found on the roots of virtually every kind of plant. It produces a slime that attaches to the roots of the plants. And actually helps plants absorb nutrients from the soil. The bacteria takes some of the nutrients out of the soil and uses that as food and breaks it down, and then the plants absorb the exudate, the waste material from the bacteria. And it's part of the cycle of life. Plants can't exist without bacteria, just like humans have to have bacteria in their intestinal tract in order to appropriately and properly digest food. Plants have to have bacteria on their roots in order to be able to absorb nutrients. And one of the most common bacteria, which is literally on every plant on the planet, and this is like the E. coli, you know, which is the lower intestinal bacteria that all mammals have, or the Acidophilus, another bacteria that is very common, and certainly in humans, I know. This is like the E. coli or Acidophilus of plants. It's called Klebsiella planticola. And a couple of years ago, actually about 7 years ago, there was a company that decided, hey, why don't we, you know, let's do something with all this excess cellulose that's out here. I mean, people, major cause of environmental pollution is burning the wheat stalks after they're done, or the rice stalks or whatever, corn stalks, you know, burning this stuff and disposing of it. Let's not do that. Let's try to convert it to something usable, like alcohol. And so they altered, genetically modified, a Klebsiella bacterium and added to it a gene that they got out of a yeast, a fermenting yeast. Now, of course, yeast, you take yeast and you add it to, for example, grape juice, and what does it produce? Alcohol, right? Therefore, wine. So they took that alcohol-producing gene out of a yeast, and they put it in the Klebsiella, and they said, this is really cool. We can create these giant fermenters, these giant tanks, and we can shovel the corn stalks into them, or the wheat, or the grass clippings from suburbia, or whatever. You know, toss in this bacteria. The bacteria, gobble, 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 gobble. It will attach itself to the plant matter, and it will digest it. It will convert the cellulose into alcohol, and we can sell the alcohol as fuel for cars. What a brilliant idea. And then when we're done, there'll be this sludge left over, which is all the minerals and all the non-cellulose stuff that the plants had absorbed from the soil. And that's actually nutritious. I mean, it might have some pesticides or heavy metals or whatever. But, you know, after we clean it up, we can put it back on crops as fertilizer. And that was the plan. And they had this genetically modified Klebsiella, and they were going to spray it on a couple of acres of crops just to try it out. You know, just to see what happens, is spray it on a field where the, you know, where there's a bunch of hay or whatever, you know, I don't, whatever the details of it are. And so Dr. Elaine Ingham at the Oregon State University says, let's check this out. And she had a student who was working on his PhD, and he said, okay, here's what we'll do. In fact, she says, but my colleagues and I asked the question, what's the effect of the sludge when it's put on the fields? This is, you know, the stuff, because would it contain live Club Ciela planicola engineered to produce alcohol? Yes, it would. Once the sludge was spread onto fields in the form of fertilizer, would the Club Ciela planicola get into root systems? Would it have an effect on ecological balance, on the biological integrity of the ecosystem, or on the agricultural soil that the fertilizer would be spread on? So they got three different kinds of jars. You know, they set this thing up in pint-sized mason jars with sterile wheat seedlings in every jar, made sure every jar was the same as all the rest. Into a third of the jars, they added water. In another third of the jars, they put the engineered Klebsiella. And in a third of the jars, they put a non-genetically modified Klebsiella. And, you know, let's see what happens. Okay, so the wheat plants grew quite well in the mason jars in the laboratory incubator until about a week after we started the experiment. I'm reading now from Elaine Ingram's comments. We came into the laboratory one morning, opened up the incubator, and went, oh my God, some of the plants are dead. What's gone wrong? What did we do wrong? We started removing the mason jars from the incubator. When we were done splitting up the mason jars, we found that every one of the genetically engineered plants in the mason jars was dead. What had happened? The Klebsiella had attached itself to the roots of the wheat plants, the genetically modified Klebsiella, and had started converting the roots into alcohol. Well, and here's what she's... And basically, the alcohol was poisoning the wheat. The wheat plants were getting drunk and dying. They were dying from alcohol toxicity. And then she goes on to say, now, here's where the problem gets real. I mean, this is a bacteria that if it got out in the wild, it would spread all around the earth because it is a bacteria that is literally on every plant on planet Earth, every plant that has roots. She says, and I'm quoting again from her, she says, the logical extrapolation from this experiment is to suggest that it's possible to make a genetically engineered microorganism that would kill all terrestrial plants. Since Klebsiella planicola is in the root system of all terrestrial plants, presumably all terrestrial plants would be at risk. A little bit mind-boggling. They published their research, and the company suspended their plans to spray this bacteria on this field. And the world was saved. That was in 1998. Have we learned anything from that? Are there any laws that have to do with how genetically modified organisms can be distributed into the environment? Well, no. The Bush administration's official policy is, well, if we discover something's dangerous, then we'll do something about it. I mean, it's once again, I mean, you just kind of keep rolling along. Belgium is one of 18 countries that have been sent samples of a deadly flu virus by an American laboratory in error. You might have heard about this in the news. It's just, this is, you know, the samples of Asian flu were sent to more than 3,700 laboratories in 18 countries. This is a virus that killed between 1 and 4 million people between 1957 and 1968. Here's their concern. If you were born after 1968, you don't have immunity to this virus. It's the H2N2 virus, as I recall. Let me check here. Yeah, H2N2. The H2N5 is the deadly one, the bird flu one that they're scared of, because that's also the Spanish flu is the H2N5. And you know, that's there. If that thing comes out of Asia, then we have a real problem. But here, the H2N2, this still killed millions of people. And they're saying anybody, well, you know, it's... I'm not going to make generational jokes around this. I shouldn't do it. Anyhow, the error has sparked concerns of a global health scare and bioterrorism. Klaus Stohr of the World Health Organization said, and I quote, if the virus is not handled properly, it can easily cause an influenza epidemic. Now, where did they send this virus by accident to? Bermuda, Belgium, Brazil, Canada, Chile, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Israel, Italy, Japan, Lebanon, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan, and the United States. I'm not reassured. So, I just wanted to give you a heads up on those things. Let's move back to John Bolton. Talk about politics for a few minutes here as we wrap up this hour. This is absolutely incredible. Here we have this blue ribbon commission that has been put together essentially in a very quiet way with Jimmy Carter and James Baker III as the head of it to look into election stuff. And Baker, it turns out, had part to play, as you know, in the theft of the 2000 election. Not just the disenfranchisement of tens of thousands of voters, that was Jeb Bush and Kathleen Harris's work, but the stopping the count and suing Al Gore in the United States Supreme Court. The lawsuit is Bush v. Gore. George W. Bush initiated the lawsuit. James Baker is lead lawyer, to stop the count so that they could say, we don't need no stinking voters. We don't need to know what the count. Well, in fact, Tom Feeney, the chairman of the speaker, of the House of Representatives of the state of Florida, had already said, no matter what, we're going to send Republican electors to Washington, D.C., regardless of who wins the vote. And they legally could do that. I mean, that was the outcome of Bush v. Gore, was the Supreme Court ruled the Constitution doesn't say that you have the right to vote for president. And it doesn't. It says the Electoral College decides who's president. You have a right to vote for your member of the House of Representatives. And then later in 1917, the Constitution was amended to give you a right to vote for your senator. So anyhow, James Baker is down there in Florida, and the vote count is going on, and he's like, we got to stop this thing. Where are we going to get some people? Well, they're pulling in people from all over, and they're pulling in, of course, all these aides from Tom DeLay's office to bang on the windows. And guess who else? Guess who was in South Korea on election day? Calls up Jim Baker, says, hey, Jim, you need my help? Jim says, sure. And the Republican campaign, the Bush campaign, pays for, the airfare and all the expenses for this guy to come from South Korea to Florida. And he's the guy who ran into the room where they were counting the votes when the decision came down from the Supreme Court and said, stop the count. I'm here to tell you to stop the count. I'm with the Bush-Gore campaign. Who was that? John Bolton. Pretty amazing. I'm going to get back to that in just a second. First, Vin in Santa Fe. He's a biologist on the line. Hey, Vin, you know about Klebsiella.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
It's been a long time. I'm startled by the lack of, by the presence of reductionist thinking and the lack of network thinking on the part of these people. You know, they should know better. They're biologists. They're geneticists. They should know that everything in there at the genetic, the cellular, and the multicellular level is a big network. And you just can't go making these unifactorial changes and expecting to get, single fact. It's this magic bullet approach. And it doesn't
work. Let me translate this into English for our listeners. The folks who are doing cloning and genetic engineering and genetic modification and who created this, this gene-altered Klebsiella and all this other stuff, I mean, there's some good stuff is coming out of this. For example, bacteria that produce insulin, but they're doing it with a mindset that says, that's very Aristotelian, that says that the universe is a giant machine. And all we have to do is figure out which gear to turn, exactly, the right direction, and everything will be just fine. And the universe isn't a machine, it's an organism. It's
right,
a living organism.
And it's an information network.
Yeah, actually, or you could say information networks are organisms.
Yeah,
I would say it that way, actually.
Go either way,
Yeah.
Biology is more of an information science than it is a biochemical. It's both.
Yeah.
It's part information science and part biochemical science. And if you ignore the networked information aspect, I mean, we know about the internet, we know about cellular networks, but we fail to understand that that's a basic premise of life.
Yeah.
And, you know, and...
But Jefferson understood that. Isn't that incredible? Thomas Jefferson understood that. He wrote
Thomas Jefferson understood it, absolutely.
I mean, he got it! And now we've got these scientists who are running... And all these folks in the administration going, oh, not to worry, everything's just fine. Monsanto always knows best. Or, you know, fill in the blank of the company name, not to pick on one company. But, you know, it's we can just trust the corporations to do it for
us.
Yeah, they'll take care of
it. It does come down to that, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that's, you know, unfortunately the case. Vin, thanks for the call, and thanks for sharing that with us. It's always good to hear from a real biologist on issues of biology.
Well, you're doing great, Tom. Thank
thanks.
You.
Thanks a lot, Vin. Have a good one. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Propagandists for democracy, freedom, justice, and the rule of law. What a thought. Don't tell anybody in the Bush administration. 10 minutes before the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, perhaps a Friday and Saturday voting schedule. Good advice, Coach Glenn, there in our chat room. Interesting. You get these kind of multiple currents of conversation going on, and it's interesting to follow along. Anyhow, John Bolton. John Bolton turns out to have been a partisan hack. Well, gee, that's, you know, what a shock, what a surprise. But he's also not, you know, I mean, this... There's lots of pieces to his strange career. Yesterday, Carl Ford Jr., the former Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research, that's Assistant Secretary for Intelligence and Research, supposed to find out, like, who has weapons of mass destruction, accused Bolton, this from the Center for American Progress, accused Bolton of so bullying an intelligence analyst that, to quote Carl Ford now, you can see this on C-SPAN last night, that it shook the Intelligence Bureau and prompted the Secretary of State to intervene. To stop John Bolton. He calls him an ill-suited nominee to become ambassador to the United Nations. Now, this Carl Ford Jr., this guy, calls himself... He describes himself as every bit as conservative as John Bolton. He's a dyed-in-the-wool, bright red Republican. Isn't it odd, by the way, that the Republicans have adopted red as their color, just like the old Communist Party did, just like the Communist Party did of China, and the Republicans are all in bed with China right now? Well, that's a discussion for another day. In any case, this guy, you know, says he's just as red as Bolton is, just as Republican. But he says Bolton is the quintessential kiss-up, kick-down kind of guy. Kiss-up, kick-down, those are people, usually in corporate institutions, but also in government, who suck up to their bosses on the above them and delight in trashing and belittling and humiliating people who work under them. In psychology, you might refer to it as a manifestation of borderline personality disorder. or one of several other personality disorders. Anyhow, Ford says this is John Bolton. This is the real John Bolton. And, of course, it is John Bolton who said, oh, there's in Cuba, they're making biological weapons. And it was Ford who said, no, they're not. And on it goes. That was 19 months ago. But it all goes back. It all goes back to Florida, December 9th, 2000, bursting into a library, John Bolton. I'm with the Bush-Cheney team. I'm here to stop the count. Yeah, that's the man we want in the UN, isn't it? Tom Hartman here with you. Because democracy needs a few cheerleaders.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio. Tom Hartman here. You are in the center of the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Take no imitations! And by the way, Nano, if you're listening, the folks in the chat room are apparently Nano vanished from the chat room, and everybody's like, what happened to Nano? It's one of those chat room things. And what you can get to, you go to TomHartman.com and click on live chat. That'll drop you into the message board area. Click live chat again, and it'll get you into the chat room. This, I was mentioning John Bolton. John Bolton, who turns out was working for James Baker down in Florida. He was the guy who burst into the room and said, stop the vote. I'm here to tell you to stop the vote. It's time. It's over. We're you know, it's, Supreme Court says that we're going to appoint George W. Bush. It doesn't matter what the voters of Florida say. And it wouldn't be until a year later. It was in October 11th, as I recall, or 12th or 13th, one of those dates, of 2001, right? You know, just after 9/11, that the New York Times and the Washington Post published their articles. And this is no secret. I mean, it's right there. They kind of buried it, you know, the headlines. But they published their articles that said that the lead, of course, was that if the recount had gone, this was after, by the way, this was after this consortium of news organizations got all the ballots and actually physically, manually counted all zillion ballots, whatever it was, out of Florida. And they said, if the four counties that Al Gore had said initially he wanted recounted, his first strategy was, let's just recount these four counties because this is where we think fraud is happening. If those four counties had been recounted, Gore still would have lost. And that's what made the headline and the first couple of paragraphs of the stories in the Washington Post and the New York Times. And later, one of the editors of the New York Times said the reason that they spun the story that way was because 9/11 had just happened, and they didn't want to be questioning or appear to be questioning the legitimacy of George Bush in a time of national crisis. And, you know, I'll give them that. I wouldn't have done it that. I don't think it was right. But I can understand where somebody might feel that, you know, 9/11 had just happened. They had no idea what was coming next. That there was some sense of an obligation to reduce panic, but down in the 16th or 17th paragraph in the New York Times article, they pointed out that, however, if you counted every single vote in the state of Florida, if you counted all the counties, which, by the way, is what Al Gore was suggesting later, if you had counted all the votes in Florida, then Al Gore would have beat George Bush, no matter what criteria was used. Counting undervotes, not counting undervotes, counting overvotes, not counting overvotes, judging the intent of the voter, not judging the intent of the voter, dangling chads, hanging chads, pregnant chads, dimpled chads, doesn't matter. In all scenarios, all possible scenarios, Al Gore won the election in Florida if you counted the entire state. And the guy that put a stop to the count was James Baker the third, and his assistant, John Bolton. And now we have James Baker appointed to as co-chairman with Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy Carter has got to be just absolutely shaking his head. First, he gets dissed by the Bushies on going to see the Pope. George W. says, Jimmy Carter, he actually is a good guy. We don't want to hang around with him. Have you noticed that Bill Clinton and George W. Bush are like bosom buddies these days? It gives me the creeps. I got to tell you, it just gives me the creeps. In any case, so Carter first gets dissed. He doesn't get invited to the Pope's funeral. And he was actually the first president of the United States in the history of the United States to invite the Pope to the White House. Or to invite the Pope to address Congress or whatever it was, to invite the Pope to Washington, D.C. And the Pope came. Carter. First guy, this Pope. But we're not going to invite him to the funeral. And now he has to put up with James Baker III as his co-chairman on this panel that is going to determine how to have free and fair elections in the United States of America. Now, Congressman John Conyers, who has been a guest on this program several times, particularly when he was down in Ohio looking into the hanky-panky, the considerable, well, hey, looking into the high crimes, misdemeanors, and treasonous felonies committed, in my opinion, and I think you could infer in the opinion of many of the members of the House committee that were looking into this, if you read Conyers' 50-some-odd page report that came out of his investigations in Ohio after the 2004 election. John Conyers writes a letter to Jimmy Carter. He says, and I quote, "For many of us, Mr. Baker will be forever remembered for his ultimately successful efforts to shut down the county to votes in the 2000 Florida election, and I am concerned that his involvement in that election may present a conflict with the goals and initiatives of your commission." Oh, isn't that diplomatic? What he's really saying is, you got a commission that's going to investigate the possibility of people ripping off votes, stealing elections, and committing crimes, and you've got, as your partner in this commission, a guy who ripped off votes, stole an election, and committed crimes. Not a good idea! He goes on to say, "How can an individual who played a critical role," this I'm quoting Congressman John Conyers now, "one of, in my opinion, one of the most intelligent, articulate, thoughtful, well-considered members of the United States House of Representatives, Democrat from Michigan, Congressman John Conyers," he said, "how can an individual who played a critical role in the disenfranchisement of tens of thousands of Floridians now co-chair a commission which should have as its mission ensuring that every vote counts? This is of great concern to me and should be of great concern to every single person who cares about this important issue. Online activists have been taking a close look at this issue. Please keep an eye on it." It's John Conyers begging Jimmy Carter. "Look out, Jimmy! It's a weirdo! It's a wacko! He's dangerous! He might have a gun. Who knows? He might have bombs. He may have ballots in his back pocket. Who knows what's going on?
Who knows what darkness lurks in the hearts of James Baker?"
But I can tell you, the news of today, is that 3 years after spending nearly $25 million bucks on electronic voting machines that have no paper trail, Miami-Dade County officials, the election officials in Miami-Dade County, are saying, you know, maybe we ought to go back to paper. Now, this is after the person who was in charge of the election official there, Constance Kaplan, election supervisor Constance Kaplan, after it was discovered that on her watch in this last election, where these electronic voting machines were running, hundreds of votes didn't get counted. They just simply vanished. Hundreds? How do we know it's not thousands? How do we know it's not tens of thousands? Well, the fact of the matter is we don't, because there's no paper trail. We know for sure that some hundreds have vanished, and that was enough to cause her to resign. County officials, this from the Miami Herald, an article by Naoki Schwartz, county officials say the machines have more than tripled election day costs. Lita Rodriguez-Tassef, head of the Miami-Dade Election Reform Coalition, says, quote, "You have lousy technology that doesn't inspire voter confidence, combined with outrageous costs for that lousy technology." The mayor, Carlos Alvarez, he says, "What I've noticed about this system from the very beginning is that there are so many things that can happen, and therefore maybe it's not the system we should have gotten years ago." Maybe not. So, you know, one county is learning the lesson. In the meantime, California, of course, got rid of their Secretary of State. Arnold Schwarzenegger got old Kevin out of the way there. He says, because Kevin was saying, hey, we can't have voting machines, no paper trail voting machines in California. And Arnold is going to get somebody in office there who's going to bring them back. I mean, he's going to be running for governor here pretty soon. He's going to have a machine he can rig, right? How else can he win? Well, with a lot of corporate money, I suppose. And he's working at that. He's sure working at that. Time will tell. Am I a cynic? Yes. I think, you know, I'm also an observer. I mean, this is irrational. Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894, our toll-free number all across the United States. TomHartmann.com, the website. You want to drop into our live chat room and say hi. Ed in Kansas is on the line. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up, Ed?
Well, you know, I think you hit on something just before the last break. You know, I've been listening to you for, about 6 months, and I find myself agreeing with, 90-95% of what you say.
Okay.
But I'm a conservative, Tom.
Well,
conservative.
You know, Ed, when I was 13 years old, I went door-to-door for Barry Goldwater, knocking on doors, because in my heart, I knew he was right. 1964, I worked on his campaign, and I'd read John Stormer's book, Don't Dare Call It Treason, and all that. And I'll tell you, a lot of those values and ideals, and last year, or the year before last now, I reread, after almost 30 years, Barry Goldwater's autobiography, No Regrets, his second autobiography. You know, he wrote two, one called No Regrets, and the other called Conscience of a Conservative. And you know, I got it that he was overly paranoid about the communists. You know, he just, as so many people in that era, had misjudged the power of the Soviet Union. Soviet Union was disintegrating from within because communism, as it was incarnated in the USSR, just doesn't work. You know, I mean, in my opinion, communism in general just doesn't work outside of little tiny tribes maybe or something, or kibbutzes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you know, it blinded him. I mean, you know, it blinded him in so many ways. He thought Martin Luther King had been infiltrated by communists, and so he was, you know, concerned about that. But if you set that aside, the guy, I tell you, if Barry Goldwater was alive today, or Everett Dirksen, or Dwight Eisenhower, they would be looking at what these folks who call themselves Republicans are doing, and they would be running in the other direction as fast as they can.
Absolutely, and this is why I kind of get maybe a little offended every time I hear these people called conservatives, because they're not. What are they trying to conserve? They're not trying to conserve anything. They are radical, what they want to call reform. Well, it's reshape everything in a whole new image.
But the reality is that
you hit on the right thing, Tom, when you said red states. Why did they adopt the name red? Well, that's what we should be calling them. We should be calling them reds.
There you go, Ed.
These are reds. They have taken on Stalinist attitudes. I mean, at this conference for the communists just the other day, the guy was saying, you know, no man, no problem. This was Joe Stalin's house.
Oh, yeah.
No judges.
Yeah, absolutely. That is great. Ed, it sounds like I lost you there, but that is absolutely great. I you know, it's time for the Republicans to take back their party. You know, I got to say, I call for Democrats to take back their party all the time. I say, Republicans, take back your party. Ed, you ought to show up, and thanks for the call. I really appreciate it. Ed, you ought to show up at a Republican Party gathering, local county Republican, if consider yourself a conservative, get in there in the Republican Party and take it back. They need rational people again, too. It's the True People's Radio. Tom Hartman with you. 20 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I was one of you who stood up for you.
And welcome back to the No Boring Zone, the radio home of democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. Ed in Kansas, I got to tell you, Roy in New Mexico is in our chat room right now. He's the guy who was telling us on the phone, on the air, a couple days ago about how him and a bunch of his friends showed up at the local Democratic Party meeting, and it was the day of wonderful coincidence, or maybe it wasn't a coincidence, maybe Roy was planning it. Roy, in fact, says now progressives now have a majority in this country, one-third, and anyhow, it was the day that they were having the election for who's going to be in charge of the party. And Roy and his friends, there were more of them than these old calcified, ossified, redundant, broken-down so-called Democrats. They took over the party. Ed, do the same thing with your local Republican Party. If, in fact, I'll tell you what, you want a basis for it. If you want, you know, a philosophical grounding for it, that you may find actually useful. Go to TomHartmann.com, click on the Articles on Democracy link. It's up on the top there, Articles on Democracy. And it'll take you to all an archive of, you know, my columns for Common Dreams. And scroll down to the one called Republicans, Please Take Back Your Party. And it's about the history of the Republican Party. And it actually has quotes from the Republican Party platform of 1872. I was in an antique bookstore, and I saw a copy. There were these two books, and they were like relatively cheap, actually, like $25 or something. I mean, for a book published in 1886, two copies, The History of the Republican Party, The History of the Democratic Party, published published in the late 1880s, and bought the, it was Rob Call who turned me onto these things. And told me where to find. And I got these books, and I'm reading the history of the Republican Party. And it's like the Republican Party had started out in 1856 as the Party of Reform. They were reacting against the Federalists that had imploded and become the Whigs, and then the Whigs had fallen apart. These were all the folks who believed in imperial presidencies and rule by the rich and all that kind of thing. And they just kept falling apart. And the Democrats, by the 1840s, had become basically the party of slavery and corruption, and the Republicans came along as the party of reform. And they didn't stop being that until that interval when Ulysses Grant, who added the S to his name later, by the way, it's not part of his birth name, but he thought it was cool to be U.S. Grant, right? Ulysses Grant was president. Arguably the second most corrupt administration in the history of the United States behind the George W. Bush administration. Maybe third most corrupt behind Reagan. More members of the Reagan administration were convicted of felonies while in office than in any administration in the history of the United States. But in any case, the U.S. Grant administration, this era in the 1870s, that was when the Republican Party went from being the party of reform prior to the Civil War to being, and just after the Civil War, to being the party of the robber barons after the Civil War. I mean, the robber barons were like, who can we buy off most easily? Well, the Democrats were resisting that because they were kind of this entrenched, corrupt bunch. And so the Republicans came along as a party of reform. And I'm saying, Republicans, take your party back. Turn it into what it once was. It once was a mighty party that really cared about issues and reform and the American people and America first. Do that, please. And as Democrats are taking back their party, I mean, we've got the DLC has infiltrated the Democratic Party. The corporatists and the Stalinists have infiltrated no man, no problem. The actual quote was, death is a great leveler or whatever it was. No man, no problem. Stalin killed his enemies. No man, no problem. Anyhow, Republicans, take back your party. That's what it is so important we do. As the Democrats are taking back theirs, as Greens are getting involved. If you think you're green here I am. I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. I will confess. Public apology. I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. That doesn't mean that I wouldn't get involved in the Democratic Party. You can do both. Get out there, get active. 29 minutes past the hour. We're going to get into some Walmart stuff here right after this.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
All the world over, so easy to see. People everywhere just want to be free. Listen, please.
It's the common denominator.
The valley people got to be free.
It is just the common denominator. I mean, this is welcome to the human race. We have so much in common, frankly, I think, between conservatives and liberals, and progressives, independents. We all want a clean environment. We all want rational trade laws that don't ship our jobs overseas. We all want average families to be able to earn a decent living wage, put our kids through school, pay for health care, or have our health care covered by the government one way, which we're paying for, too, with our taxes, one way or the other. Frankly, I think a national health care system, you know, let's just make Medicare universal. Let's just have Medicare cover everybody. Medicare's cost of administration is under 2%. It is incredibly efficient. There are some things that government actually does well. Fire departments are marvelous. Back when fire departments were for-profit corporations, they'd drive right by your house if you didn't pay the right, you know, if you didn't have the right sticker out front, the right medallion out front. There are some things that we do well. Anyhow, 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Logan in New York City is on the line. Hey, Logan.
Hey, Tom. I wanted to bring up an issue that's concerning me. It's this enemy combatant thing, and I wanted to know whether it was the Patriot Act or where it was coming from, and whether there are Americans currently under lock and key under this enemy combatant thing.
Yes, there are. There are two of them, and
only two.
Actually, we have no idea, because
right.
Under the Patriot Act, they don't have to tell us. Number one. And secondly, where the phrase enemy combatant came from. I had one of the lawyers from the ACLU on, it was maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago, and asked him that question because I thought, you know, there's got to be some precedent at law, because in the past you had basically people who had committed crimes, and that is they were criminals. They had broken the laws of some nation, or they had broken international laws like, you know, war crimes, or you had people who were in the field of battle. And they had broken the laws of war, as it were. And there actually are, you know, the rules of war. And so you would either be facing a military court-martial for breaking the laws of war, or a tribunal like the Nuremberg Convention, you know, the Nuremberg tribunals that tried the Nazis, or you would be facing a court. But in either case, you have the right to counsel, you have the right to the presumption of innocence, you have the right to call defendants or witnesses on the part of the defense. You have, you know, the basic human rights, because you never know. The next guy they nail could be you or me, right?
Yeah, I know.
That's the bottom line. And so I said, where did this enemy combatant thing come from? And he said, they just made it up.
And who's it up to, the president?
He just made it up, yes. It came out of the executive branch. They just made it up out of thin air. It has no legal basis. It has no legal standing. It's not in the Patriot Act. It's not in any UN charter or any treaties or anything. They made it up.
And how long before they started extending it to liberals?
Yeah, well, you know, or, you know, how long since they have? I mean, we just don't know. This is the scary thing. This is why... You know, here I am, you know, this old guy who was back in the 60s, you know, out there marching against the war in Vietnam and, you know, saying back then I was wondering, you know, is the rule of law really a good thing? Because I felt like the law was being used against us. And here I am calling for the rule of law because we've lost it. We've lost it. We're losing the rule of law is so important.
Yeah, it's so dangerous, Tom, but I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for the call, Logan. Good to hear from you, and glad to have you listening there. Anyhow, we're moving along. Let's get into economics a little bit.
Walmart.
Ah, yes.
If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big company sell for low cost. Drive mom and pop out of business.
It's our Walmart alert.
All over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why.
Yes, well, the union.
Stop in on three or four towns, encounter different sights and sounds, different if not unique. Different accent, different smell, different things to buy and sell. Now it's all Taco Bell. I hate Walmart.
I just had it goes on and on. I just love it. Anyhow, the Wall Street Journal reports today a food workers union in the first paragraph. The Wall Street Journal, they can't quite bring themselves to name a union in the first sentence of an article unless the union's being indicted for something. A union does something good. They can't quite bring themselves to name it. So the name of the union is down in the 1, 2, 3, 4th paragraph. But it's the United Food and Commercial Workers Union, the UFCW, one of the fastest growing unions in the United States, one of the really vigorous unions. And they're the one that had been out there trying to unionize Walmart. And, you know, trying to change things here. A food workers union, this is the UFCW, said it filed charges. This is the article by Courtney Stringer in today's Wall Street Journal. Said it filed charges of unfair labor practices against Walmart Stores, Inc. to pressure the retailer to release documents relating to allegations that Walmart's former number two executive, that would be Thomas Coughlin, the guy that we talked about on the program yesterday and the day before, Walmart's former number two executive may have financed covert anti-union efforts. Now, what this is all about, and the irony is absolutely delicious here, because it was the Wall Street Journal that broke the story. What this is all about is that this guy, Thomas Coughlin, is saying that the money that he is accused of stealing from Walmart as an executive when he was having Walmart, like, you know, buy him $1,300 boots and pay $2,500 for a dog pen and, you know, weird things like that. He's saying, well, you know, really that money was to reimburse me for money that I was paying out of my pocket or secretly paying under the table to members of the union that were helping us formulate an anti-union strategy for Walmart. And so this guy is like, you know, he's accused of stealing from the company. And his defense is, well, no, actually I was engaged in union busting. So the union says, well, we'd like to know something about that. Can you give us a few details, please? Walmart, of course, says, don't think so. Nope. We're not going to do that. Walmart saying, no, the guy's just a crook. You know, it's expense account abuses. UFCW says, well, what if he's telling the truth? I mean, after all, he was the number two guy in Walmart. Didn't you always say he was telling the truth? He used to be Sam Walton's protege. The allegations, this is Greg Dentner, he's a food union spokesman. Again, the Wall Street Journal can't quite say it. UFCW spokesman, Greg Denier. He says, the allegations that have been reported are criminal violations of federal labor law. And those violations were designed to suppress the rights of workers. And so, you know, the union that represents the rights of workers says, yeah, we'd like to know what's going on. But I got to tell you, what's really going on here is the larger picture. And the larger picture is, and this goes back to the founding of this country. This goes back to John Adams and Alexander Hamilton. This goes back to the big debate that that they were having in 1773, in the spring and summer of 1773, before the Boston Tea Party that winter, about whether or not we should separate from England. Because there were a lot of people, the majority of Americans, the majority of colonists, who believed that aristocracy was actually the most stable form of government, that aristocracy was the appropriate form of government, was the appropriate way things should be. So, you know, it's like, this is still continuing. I got to say, by the way, you drop into our chat room, TomHartmann.com, Freddie. Show engineer is Louise, so here she is, helping out. Anyhow, as I was saying, so all these folks who actually believe that aristocracy is like, well, this is from the first hour, too. You know, this is the argument between Jefferson and Adams. John Adams also said, you know, democracies always die. Well, we didn't have much history of democracies back then. They just looked at the Greeks, and that was a pure democracy. It took 6,001 people showing up to vote on anything of meaning or of consequence. And, you know, a jury was 501 people, was what convicted Socrates. So, you had some pretty big numbers there, kind of unwieldy for a new republic. But there were these folks who believed that the most stable form of government is essentially a kingdom or an aristocracy, rule by the rich, rule by the powerful, an oligarchy, the royal families. And this is what you still have today in most of Central and South America. It's what you have in most of the Third World. It's what was the main form of governance in Europe for thousands of years, in China, in Japan. It still is in China. Only it's called the Communist Party, but it's another oligarchy. And we now are moving in this direction here in the United States, into the direction of being ruled by feudal barons and lords, by being ruled by an elite that identifies themselves as an elite, that says that they are the elite, and that because of that, they know best. There's this whole notion of noblesse oblige. The obligation of nobility to look out for the little people, to make sure that things run right. And the reason, of course, is because they don't want what happened to Louis the whichever it was, Louis the 15th, I guess it was, or Louis the 16th. That Louis the 16th was his son. Anyhow, that Louis back there, who was married to Marie Antoinette, they don't want what happened to him to happen to them, which was the people rose up and said, enough of this. Maybe it was Louis the 14th. I always mix up my Louis. And it's just must be because of that Louis song when I was a kid. But so here we have, in 2004, the average CEO of a major company received $9.84 million in total compensation, according to the New York Times, a 12% increase over 2003, while the average worker's paycheck grew only 3.6%. And you will hear from the, you know, millionaire commentators in the network media news, oh, this means the economy is doing well. Well, it is if you're a millionaire. At Coca-Cola, for example, notes the AFL-CIO, the report shows the company paid CEO Douglas Daff some $36 million when he retired in 2004. Not bad. Even at an hourly wage of $9.64, working 34 hours a week, a Walmart employee earns only $17,043 annually. That's under the $18,850 federal poverty guideline for a family of four in 2004. What's wrong with this picture? Here we have, for example, see that now the AFL-CIO has got this new campaign. They're trying to out these CEOs and saying, you know, what's wrong with it? And they're using the argument. They're using the argument that the outrageous CEO pay is actually taking money away from stockholders. That's a nice argument. I mean, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense, and it's you know, it's an appeal to the noblesse oblige class, right? It's to the ownership class in America. But I would say it's really the issue is, do you want to have a society that has a coherent social structure to it? Do you want to have a stable democracy? And believe me, what we're talking about here ultimately is the survival of democracy. And as Jefferson so eloquently pointed out, and as I documented in my book, What Would Jefferson Do?, in his own words, in order for you to have a democracy, you must have what Jefferson referred to as the plowman and yeoman class, what today we would call the middle class, the farmers and workers. You must have a stable middle class. And you can't have the Dickensian world of a terrified working class where everybody has to there are no more single wage families. Instead, everybody and everybody's just skating by, and everybody's two paychecks away from bankruptcy. And by the way, let's reform the bankruptcy laws. And so they're outing folks like Sprint Corporation. Gary Forsey, the CEO of Sprint, last year made $19,480,225. That is $9,365 an hour. An hour they paid this guy. $9,365 an hour. I mean, like every hour. That's a minimum wage worker's salary for a whole year. And his total equity and net worth, this is, you know, he also has unexercised stock options as of the end of the year, worth $35 million, and share ownership worth $40,900,000. Total is $76,546,296 in compensation to Gary Forsey of Sprint Corporation. That's $36,801 an hour. And he's not the worst. He's just the one that they outed today. Paywatch.org, by the way, is their website. The AFL-CIO doing this. We have seen a tremendous amount of interest among workers in holding CEOs and their boards accountable, AFL-CIO's Secretary Treasurer Richard Trumka said in a news release. They are rightfully outraged when they learn about jaw-dropping executive compensation packages. Yes, and they would much rather we be talking about Terry Schiavo or Michael Jackson, I can tell you. Terry Semel, CEO of Yahoo, who made $109,301,385 last year. Let's see, that must be, if this is 75, that would be about $45,000 an hour. Or Steve Jobs, chairman of Apple, $86 million last year. Lee Frankfurt of Coach Incorporated, $54 million last year. TXU Corp., John C. Wilder, $54 million. Occidental Petroleum, Ray Arani, $52 million. You know, I just, please tell me, what makes anyone worth $38,000 a year? What do you do other than knowing the right network, being connected to the right people? What can you do that would make you worth that? And if it's only about having gone to the right school so that you're connected to the right people, so you're part of the right network, so you're part of the right political families, then we don't have democracy anymore. We have oligarchy. Rule by the royal families. $38,000 an hour. Excuse me. I said year. 10 minutes before the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by.
Oh, and I wish you a beautiful day.
Shaking hands, saying how do you do? They're really saying I love you.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here, the place where smart people get their news. The True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. Business Week found that CEO pay raises once again dwarf those of the average worker. They said, and I quote, nearly 40 of the nation's chief executives walked away with more than $20 million, excluding windfalls from option exercises. There have been improvements, but pay for performance is still not the standard practice everywhere. Some corporate boards, at least, are still lavishly rewarding CEOs who deserve far less. Yeah. Last year, union-sponsored pension plans won majority shareholder support for an unprecedented 34 proposals on CEO pay. Well, what do the cons want to do about this? What are the Republicans and the conservative Democrats in Congress going to do about this situation, about the fact that, for example, if there's a Walmart in your area, out of your taxes, out of your local taxes, if there's a Walmart in your area, you're paying, you being the collective community, $36,000 for free and reduced school lunches for the children of 50 qualifying Walmart families, as average for a store, who qualify, $42,000 for Section 8 federal housing assistance, $125,000 for federal tax credits and deductions for low-income families, $100,000 for Title I educational funds based on 50 qualifying Walmart families with an average of two children, $9,750 for energy assistance subsidies for low-income families. Well, you're paying that. Well, what's the response of the cons? Let's do away with the estate tax. After all, it's going to hit the heirs of Sam Walton. Yes, I'm serious. I'm serious. We have a federal deficit of $400 billion. Last year, the estate tax was paid by only 30,627 people. If you raised the estate tax to $3.5 million, only 8,500 people will pay it. But they are the families, the heirs of Sam Walton and whatnot. They are the families who write the big checks to Congress, who write the big checks to fund the conservative think tanks. They are the families who are calling the tune. It is an oligarchy. Meanwhile, the revenue from a reformed estate tax could fill in between one quarter and one half of the expected Social Security shortfall over the next 75 years. But no, the Bushies want to get rid of it. Get rid of it. That's the solution. That'll solve all our problems. Ain't life wonderful? Get active, my friends. It's time to get active.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The Tom Hartman Program, where being progressive never felt so good. Where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? Well, John Chandler Bancroft Davis may have said so back in 1886, but I can tell you, he weren't right. Although, we do have this small problem of, you know, it's...
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
He gets to decide everything, right? It's that seems to be the case here. George W. Bush trying to push through the nomination of Judge William G. Myers III. This is one of the... Now, keep in mind, the Republicans filibustered judicial appointments during the Clinton administration and during the Carter administration. And, I mean, this is, you know, this is nothing new. And only 10 judges, which is, you know, a very, very small number compared to the Republican, the number that the Republicans blocked. The Republicans blocked well over 100. I don't recall the exact number. Don't have it in front of me. My recollection is like 120, something like that, during the Clinton years. Only 10 were blocked by Democrats. And yet, Bill Frist is making a big stink out of it. One of these guys is, you know, here's a great for example, William G. Myers III, a nominee for the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco. Did he lie when he told a Senate committee that he was... This is, now, let me just back up a little bit. William G. Myers III used to be a lobbyist for the mining and cattle industries. Therefore, he's the perfect person in the minds of the Bush administration to... make a top lawyer with the Interior Department, right? The Interior Department is who passes out land, government land that you and I own, the rights to mine on that land, the rights to drill on that land, or the rights to graze your cattle on that land. It's the Interior Department. So William Myers, the former lobbyist for the mining and cattle industry, of course he'd be the perfect person to be a top lawyer at the Interior Department. Well, it turns out that while he was the top lawyer at the Interior Department, this is from 2001 to 2003, there was this little case of a guy named Harvey Frank Robbins. Old Harvey had been facing 16 different trespassing violations. That is, he was misusing federal lands. He was using federal lands in ways that were, well, illegal, you know. And... so the Interior Department did a couple of things when Harvey Frank Robbins' case, you know, when the Bushies came over and William G. Myers III became the top lawyer for the Interior Department, they changed the rules. They said, okay, we're going to change the rules. So what he did isn't against the law anymore, and we're going to drop the charges against him, and there's no charges for new violations can be brought against him or anyone other than the director, you know, by him, against him, by anyone other than the director of the Federal Bureau of Land Management, as the Progress Report, the Center for American Progress today points on. On top of that, the agreement gave Robbins special rights, to access federal lands for grazing and to build a dude ranch. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Myers was the top lawyer, apparently put this deal together. According to his calendar, which an environmentalist group got through the Freedom of Information Act, he met with Comer, Robert Comer. This is another department lawyer who's working on this case. 8 days after he received a fax from Comer about this case, about the Harvey Frank Robbins case, asking if Judge William G. Myers III, then head lawyer for the Interior Department, quote, wanted any other changes to the settlement agreement, end quote. 8 days later, he meets with the other lawyers. 6 days after that, the final deal is signed. Okay, so we got this deal. You got this incredibly wealthy rancher, you know, and the Bush administration giving the guy a pass. Nothing surprising about that, frankly. I mean, you know, it's look out for our friends, and, you know. But here's where it gets interesting. So Myers goes before Congress in his confirmation hearings. And Russ Feingold says, did you have anything to do with this sweetheart deal for this Wyoming rancher? And Myers says, no. Didn't know about it. And Russ Feingold is now calling for an investigation into, well, to quote Senator Russell Feingold of Wisconsin, whether William G. Myers III, a nominee for the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco, lied when he told a Senate committee that he was not aware of the terms of a controversial settlement the Interior Department had made with a politically connected Wyoming rancher until months after the deal was signed, end quote. Yeah, well, we'll see how it shakes out. But the bottom line is that the litmus test for Bush judicial nominees is not integrity or competence. It's loyalty and doctrine. Very simply, loyalty and doctrine. I want to get into the bankruptcy bill briefly. This is something that's going to be coming before the House of Representatives this week in all probability, perhaps even today, probably tomorrow or the next day, or maybe next week. We'll see how it goes. But first, let's take a phone call here. 1-866, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-889-8894, if you'd like to be on the program. Brian in New Jersey on the line. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to respond to something that you've been saying lately about getting active. I just wanted to say, just a comment. It's so easy. If you could take 5 minutes of your day, you know, 7 days in a week, boom, you have a little over a half hour to do anything. And I think people feel like they don't know what to do or defeated, but it really is as simple as either calling a radio show like this or calling, you know, 1-877-SOB-USOB or...
Right, which is the phone number for the House of Representatives, the Senate, and the White House, the toll-free
exactly.
number.
I mean, I'm as pessimistic as the next person, but if I feel like I do my part, I can take about 45 minutes out of my day, which I do, to do all these things and go to board meetings. But, you know, you can be pessimistic and still do something. So even if something does happen, you can be like, oh, well, I tried.
There
so
you
just,
go.
You know, tell
well,
everyone...
It's not even, Brian, oh, well, I tried. It's, hey, I did something. I made some small change.
Yeah.
If a lot of other people do that, and the day will come, trust me, Brian,
other
people do that, we're going to make some big changes.
The universe is so huge. That
there you go.
On the grand scale, it's nothing, but we can do something. I agree. So thanks for being out there.
Yeah, and you are. And, Brian, I appreciate that. That is great of you to be making those phone calls like that and doing that. Thanks so much for the call and for charging us up. I appreciate it. Keep up the good work. Stay with it. That's great. I'm preaching to the converted here. It is about creating change. And the way you create change is you get active. And it starts very simply. Doesn't cost you a penny. You call toll free. Not me. I mean, you're welcome to call me at 1-866-889-8894. But call toll free the United States Capitol. The number is 877-SOB-U, the letter U, S-O-B. And it actually is Senate Office Building. That's what it's supposed to stand for. But it's 1-877-SOB-U-S-O-B. Call that number and you can say, hey, I'd like to speak to, and name your senator. If you don't know your senator, say, hey, I'm calling from Ohio. I'm not sure who my senators are. Who are they? Or I'm calling from Cleveland, and I'm not sure who my congressman is. Who is that person? Or congresswoman, who's my member of Congress? And odds are they'll be able to tell you, and once you figured it out, they will connect you. Or, hey, I'd like to talk to the White House. I'd like to leave my opinion with their switchboard. It's really not particularly difficult. And it does make a difference. And the most important thing, of course, is to call your own representatives and give them your real name and address and telephone number. It won't get sold as a spam list. In fact, you'll probably get a letter back from them thanking you for your input, which you can, you know, put in a frame and hang on the wall or sell on eBay, 20 years from now for $4 or something. But here is one of those things that it's worth getting a little exorcised over. The Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act of 2005. Now, what sort of abuse is this act preventing, and what sort of consumer is it protecting? First of all, on there was a series of amendments that were proposed to this, and there's just a great analysis that Hunter posted on the Daily Coast today, and or over the, actually it was over this last weekend, and just a great resource. Three Democrats, first of all, who consistently voted with the Republicans. Let's out these guys. Senator Nelson, Democrat of Nebraska, Senator Johnson, Democrat of South Dakota, and Senator Carper, Democrat of Delaware. Now, I guess you'd expect Delaware is where the many of the credit card companies are based, and South Dakota, I believe, is where many of the credit card companies are based. So these guys are, you know, they're probably under incredible pressure. But nonetheless, whose bidding are they supposed to be doing in the United States Senate? I mean, why were they elected? Were they elected by MBNA? Were they elected by Citibank? Or were they elected by you and me? I mean, what is democracy, after all? Well, first of all, the Abuse and Prevention Act, the Bankruptcy Abuse and Prevention Act, number one, covers Chapter 7 and Chapter 13, which are the two types of bankruptcies that individuals do. It does not touch Chapter 11. Doesn't touch it. Why? There's plenty of abuse of Chapter 11. I can tell you right now, Donald Trump is using it. I can't say he's abusing it. I don't know, you know, the details, but I can tell you he's using it. Donald Trump is in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Why are they not touching that? Because that's the bankruptcy provision that corporations use. It allows businesses to reorganize themselves, get out under certain debt, you know, avoid paying bills, that kind of thing. So we can see, first of all, that the Republicans who put this thing together, they view abusers of credit as being solely individuals. We couldn't have any corporations abusing the bankruptcy laws. Not possible. No. And the only people needing protection are the corporations, because that's you know, who's being protected by this thing. So the Democrats have been trying to put their stamp on this bill, and they've introduced a few amendments. And over the next few minutes, I just want to share a few of these with you. Senator Schumer, a Democrat of New York, put forward Amendment number 42 to limit the exemption for asset protection trusts. What you say is an asset protection trust? Well, there are states like Utah where you can actually create a trust. You go to a bank and you say, I'm going to create a trust. It's almost like a corporation. You put all of your assets in it. You know, it's in my home, my $60 zillion, my, you know, whatever, my yacht. You know, it's all in this asset protection trust. And then you go into bankruptcy and none of that stuff can be touched. And right now, even if you do it, even if you live in California and you create an asset protection trust in Utah, yeah, it is exempt from the bankruptcy laws. Republicans said, leave it the way it is. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Yes. Bill Donovan. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason and passion go together like Republican presidential news conferences and gay hookers. Okay, here you got it. If you are a millionaire or a billionaire, you can go to Utah, and there's a few other states you can do it. Utah is one of the more well-known for it. You can go to one of these states that allow for the creation of asset protection trusts, and you can set up what's essentially a corporate form. It's called a trust. You create a trust instrument, legal document, and you move all of your assets into that, put your house in it, put your car in it, put your bank account in it, put, you know, everything you have in it. Leave a little bit out so it looks like you're actually declaring bankruptcy. And you don't even have to live in Utah. You can live in Connecticut or New York or Los Angeles or California. You could live in Oregon, Vermont, wherever you want. You create this asset protection trust in Utah and put your millions in it. And then you go to court and declare Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 bankruptcy. Say, I am bankrupt. I am sorry. I'm broke. I can't pay back my bills. I owe $1 million to this guy. Or, you know, I owe $30,000 in credit card. Whatever. And the bankruptcy court has to say, okay, we are going to have to pretend that that asset protection trust doesn't exist. We can't look at that when we're talking about, you know, dividing up your assets and splitting them out and paying people back or figuring out what you can appropriately pay. All that, we can't look at that. It's against the law. That is protected. So Charlie Schumer, good old Chuck Schumer, senator from New York, says, well, you know, if we're going to reform the bankruptcy laws, let's do away with asset protection trusts. And the Republicans in the Senate, as well as Democrats Nelson, Johnson, and Carper, said, what? Are you kidding? That's the only way millionaires, like most of the Senate, can protect all their wealth if anything were to happen. Now, it's not something that you or me could use. It's not something the average person could use. Somebody, you know, if you got resources, a couple $1,000 in resources, your house or what, forget it. But if you're a millionaire, it's there for you. So Chuck Schumer offers this amendment to eliminate asset protection trusts. I mean, after all, you're going to reform bankruptcy? No, they voted down. Insane. Dale in Nebraska, 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Hey, Dale, what's on your mind?
Good show, as always, Tom.
Thank you, Dale.
I'm just calling to rant.
Okay.
Okay. The reason I'm calling in, though, is I got in late on your show, and probably most of the people have seen the news on the Hank Greenberg case with AIG, where he transferred $2.2 billion of stock to his wife. I wonder if that money's going to go into an asset protection trust.
Yeah, and Warren Buffett is running for cover on this thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Unfortunately. Yeah. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I'll bet you Kenny Lay has got one.
Sure. It's only $2.2 billion, though, Tom.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's chump change to some of these folks.
Well,
I mean,
know.
Seriously, it is. You look at the roughly 8,000 families that if the inheritance tax was raised to $3.5 million, who would have to pay an inheritance tax, and it's chump change to them.
Well, he still owns approximately, I think it's $1.4 million of AIG.
Yeah.
And all of this value, or a good share of it, came through inflated pricing, which... That would help all of us if we could inflate our money.
Yeah, it was a little bit of an Enron venture, shall we say, without getting too technical on it. It's, if you play with the numbers, you skim the money off the top, and then you leave the stockholders or you leave the employees or you leave, you know, holding the bag. It's an old trick, and for all of Bush's rhetoric, he's done really nothing at all to stop it.
You know, Tom.
Yeah, got to be quick here.
I think the public needs to look at these kind of companies that the CEOs are getting those kind of compensation packages.
Yeah.
And boycott them by selling their stock.
Yeah. Stockholders, absolutely. And that's what the AFL-CIO is doing. Well said, Dale. I mean, they've got this whole campaign to hold these people accountable, and they're using their stock to do it. 29 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
He took all the trees and put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half to see them.
Yeah, that's the new Enron plan.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? You feel paradise and put up a fucking lie.
You know, Enron actually had had cut a deal with Jeb Bush to take over the Everglades. Oh, my. Back to the bankruptcy bill. The bankruptcy bill coming before the House of Representatives. Your last chance to call your congressman or congresswoman, your member of Congress, the United States House of Representatives, the telephone number toll-free for the U.S. House of Representatives, 1-877-SOB-USOB. your last chance to call and say, you vote for that bankruptcy bill, and I'm not voting for you. And I'm telling my friends. You know, I have a feeling that there's a few senators who would have changed their tune had they gotten calls like that before this thing came out. It kind of went through the Senate and really wasn't getting a lot of publicity. But look at some of the things that the Democrats tried to do to clean this bill up. I think this was a genuine good faith effort to try and clean it up a little bit. For example, the Durbin Amendment. Dick Durbin put in an amendment. It's Amendment number 49. It was, well, here's exactly the language. To protect employees and retirees from corporate practices that deprive them of their earnings and retirement savings when a business files for bankruptcy. In other words, if you are an employee of Enron, let's say, or you were, and you had your 401k, you had all your retirement money invested in the company's 401k fund, which was invested in Enron stock, and all of your available cash you had put into Enron stock because Ken Lay kept saying, hey, buy more stock. It drives up the price and increases my options value. But in any case, say you had done that. And Enron goes down the tubes after Ken and Jeff and all these others walk away with their millions or more. And you're not only out your retirement funds and out your liquid cash, you're also out of a job. And now you can't pay the mortgage and you can't pay the health insurance and the kids, you can't get new clothes for the kids, and you're having to go down and get food stamps, and you've maxed out your credit cards. And Dick Durbin said, you know, somebody in a situation like that, we shouldn't force them into Chapter 13 bankruptcy where they're going to have to pay those bills forever. We should allow them to declare Chapter 7 bankruptcy even if they're not indigent. Chapter 7 bankruptcy where you just get to wipe the slate clean on, you know, like your credit card bills and things, and start over. So that's basically what this bankruptcy reform in so-called legislation is all about. It's about preventing basically middle-class people who hit hard times but still have a few assets. They still have some equity in their house, for example. Preventing them from declaring Chapter 7 bankruptcy where you can just say, that's it, I'm not paying that anymore, and the debt is wiped clean. Instead of trying to do Chapter 13 bankruptcy, which is where basically you get a breather, your creditors can't come banging on your door, they can't haul your car away, but you do have to pay back that money over a longer period of time. And basically what this reform legislation does is it says, unless you are absolutely flat out broke, unless you have totally exhausted everything that you own, you no longer qualify for Chapter 7 bankruptcy. You're going to have to do Chapter 13. You are going to be a slave to debt. I believe www.debtslavery.org, David Swanson's website, has some great information on this. I hope that URL is right. Suspect somebody in the chat room will correct me if I'm wrong on that. So anyhow, Dick Durbin proposes this amendment that would protect employees who get into the Enron situation, and it's not like it doesn't happen a lot. Or you're working for a corporation, and a thief. Somebody steals your 401k or whatever. Yeah, that amendment was rejected. 100% of the Republicans voted against it. 100%. And Senator Nelson of South Dakota, the Democrat, voted against it to protect employees whose companies went down because of crimes. I mean, is this unreasonable? Well, here's another one. Amendment 38, another one put forward by Dick Durbin. Amendment 38 to discourage predatory lending practices. This is the one where, you know, the credit card companies say, oh, yeah, you can get 3% interest, or we'll finance your home and 4.5%. And really, in the fine print there, it says, for any reason at all, we can simply change the terms of this. Good luck, you're out of luck, or, you know, whatever. And to put some regulations into place, or to say people who are the victims of predatory lending. You know, these paycheck places where that are particularly popular around military bases, where people go in and they get an advance on their paycheck. You know, they get their paycheck's going to be $300. They get the $300 a week early. And then when their paycheck comes, they have to take it there and give it to them. And they're paying the equivalent of 100% annual interest. This used to be against the law. It used to be called usury. The ceiling used to be 10%. And in the 70s, when inflation went out of control, in the late years of the Nixon administration, as I recall, in the 70s, they had to, you know, do away with the usury ceilings and do away with the usury. Now they've done away with the usury laws altogether. There's basically no ceiling. And so they're saying, hey, let's put in an amendment to control this kind of predatory lending behavior, this kind of stuff that intentionally nails people. All of the Republicans voted against that amendment. All of them. 100%. They were joined by Democrats Nelson, Johnson, and Carper. Every single Republican senator. Or Amendment number 37. This was put forward by Nelson in Florida. Amendment number 37, to exempt debtors from means testing if their financial problems are caused by identity theft. What if you get wiped out by identity theft? Aaron Brown did a whole special on it last night on CNN. You know, this is like, I mean, hundreds of people a day are getting their identities stolen. And they get wiped out. They've got nothing left. They thought they had money in the bank. They thought they had a credit card. They thought they had credit. Now they can't even rent a vacuum cleaner at the local U-Haul store or whatever, because their credit says that they've lost everything. They're wiped out, and it's going to take them a while to build it. It's not their fault. They're not scofflaws. They're not abusers of credit. Let's protect them. Let's give them an opportunity to start. See, the whole point of the bankruptcy laws in the first place was that in the United States we have two things. A sense of fairness, and we want to encourage risk. Now, first of all, sense of fairness, I think that's pretty obvious. Makes, you know, you get that right on its face. If somebody, for example, has been hurt because they were the victims of predatory lending, or they were the victims of identity theft, it wasn't their fault. So they shouldn't be punished for it, is, you know, how we would look at it. It's not how the Republicans look at it, but it's what these amendments suggested. That's that. Now, why, though, would we want to encourage risk? Well, very simply, very straightforward, the reason that we want to encourage risk is because it's people who have taken risks in the United States, economic risks, who have made this country great. They are the entrepreneurs. They are the investors. And I'll tell you, most entrepreneurs are average middle-class people, starting out with very, very little, working with money that they borrowed from friends and family. First business I ever started, I started with money from an unemployment check. Maybe I shouldn't say that on the air. I don't know. Is that illegal to use your unemployment check to start a business? I don't think so. I couldn't find a job. This was back in the early 70s. I started a business. I was on unemployment. I took a risk. I knew that if I went down in flames, that worst thing that could happen, I could declare bankruptcy, and for 7 years, I would have a very, very hard time getting credit. There is a downside to it, but I took a risk, and I started a business, and it made some money. It was successful. It employed people. And that's what happens. That's what happens in America. That's what we want to have happen. And that's why we have these bankruptcy laws, to have fairness and to encourage risk. Reasonable risk. The kind of risk that builds a country. Well, it's not the Republicans' idea of it. The Republicans' idea of it is that we should have the bankruptcy laws keep Chapter 11 intact to protect corporations so they can declare bankruptcy, that Donald Trump's casino can declare bankruptcy, and keep asset protection trusts in place so anybody who has net worth over a couple of $1 million can declare bankruptcy and still keep all their money. But everybody else, throw them into Chapter 13 where they have to spend at least 5 years paying it all back. No matter what it does to their lifestyle, no matter what it does to their home. Here's another amendment. Senator Dayton offered this amendment, Senate Amendment Number 31, to limit the amount of interest that can be charged on any extension of credit to 30%. Right, this is going back to the usury laws. The usury laws used to be you charge more than 10%, you're exploiting people, you're taking advantage of people, particularly people who don't have good credit, who are just starting out. You know, kids just out of college, their first job, they just got married, they're trying to buy a house, they're trying to get a credit, they don't have any kind of credit history. Instead of being allowed to exploit people like this, there should be some kind of a ceiling. You can't charge more than 10% interest is what it used to be when I was, you know, starting out. Well, now they're saying, well, let's put a cap of 30% on it. You realize 30% interest, about every 2.5 years, you're paying 100% back. You borrow $1,000 in 2.5 years, you owe another $1,000 back. It's incredible. What a profit to be a lender, to get a 30% return on loans. You can't do that in the stock market, I'll tell you. You would think that 30% would be like sufficiently generous for the Republicans in the United States Senate, but no. Every single senator on the Republican side voted against this, as did 19 Democrats, including Senator John Kerry. Or what about Amendment 32? This from John Corzine. Amendment number 32 to the Bankruptcy Protection Act, the bankruptcy law, to preserve existing bankruptcy protections for individuals experiencing economic distress as caregivers to ill or disabled family members. In other words, if your spouse gets cancer or some, you know, incurable disease and you can't work for 6 months or a year because you've got to take care of that person or your child, And the consequence of that is that it throws you into bankruptcy, or even it's that you can't work. It's not that you can't work, but you can't afford the medical bills, whatever, and you have to be the caregiver to an ill or disabled family member, then you have available to you Chapter 7 bankruptcy. You won't be forced into Chapter 13 and have to repay that money. You have to work for the next 20 years to make up for that year that you had to take off because your spouse was dying or your child was dying. Sounds kind of nice. Sounds kind of reasonable. Yeah. All 54 Republican senators voted against it. 5 Democratic senators and Jim Jeffords, the independent. Strip them away. Democrats, Baucus, Bingaman, Carper, Johnson, and Nelson of Nebraska. What about Amendment number 28? Amendment number 28 would exempt debtors whose financial problems were caused by serious medical problems from means testing. In other words, even if you still have your house or a little piece of it, you can't be forced into Chapter 13. You can still do Chapter 7 if your economic crisis is brought about by medical bills. Rejected. What about Amendment 28 that Kennedy put forward? Kennedy put forward both of these, 28 and 29. What about Amendment number 29 to provide protection for medical debt homeowners? Okay, the medical debt is wiping you out. At least you can keep your home. Republicans, all of the Republicans, no. All the Republicans. Every single Republican in the Senate said no. Average working people wiped out by medical debts, keep their homes, no. As well as Democratic Senators Biden, Carper, Johnson, and Nelson. Or what about Senate Bill Amendment number 15 to require enhanced disclosure to consumers regarding the consequences of making only minimum required payments in the repayment of credit card debt and for other purposes? You know, if you only make the minimum payment, you end up in debt forever. So let's force people, let's force the credit card companies to say, if you only make this minimum payment, you're only paying interest. You're always going to have this debt. We're going to make 100% profit off you forever. Forcing the credit card companies to disclose the consequences of this, rejected. All of the Republicans voted to reject it. 100% of them, and they were joined by Democrats Baucus, Biden, Carper, Johnson, and Nelson. What about a homestead floor for the elderly? If you're elderly and you're bankrupt, can you keep your home? Can you go into Chapter 7 instead of Chapter 13? Rejected. Each and every Republican senator, along with Jeffords, Biden, Casper, and Nelson, voted to reject this provision that would have prevented seniors from losing their homes. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Now that things have changed, everything's careful and rearranged. And not a thing is done, except for reason.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC. What about Amendment 16 to protect service members and veterans? Offered by Senator Durbin, rejected! 100% of the Republicans voted against it, along with Democrats Baucus, Biden, Byrd, Casper, Johnson, and Nelson. What is going on? Are you getting it? Contact Congress, 1-877-SOB-USOB is the telephone. It truly is the toll-free number for Congress. Ask for your member of Congress and say, you vote for this bankruptcy bill, you're going to be toast. In terms of my vote, be careful how you phrase that. You don't want to have the Secret Service tracking you down. Ed in San Juan, Puerto Rico on the line. Hey, Ed, what's up today?
No, Puerto Rico, California.
Oh, even better.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Ed.
I can tell you've never owed the IRS any money.
Actually, I have.
The reason why they don't want to change anything and to help this law and usury is because if you owe them money, you owe them a dollar, tomorrow you owe them 10.
Oh, because the IRS is charging interest as well, you mean?
One of the worst things I've ever done was owe them money and try to dispute it.
Yeah.
By the time it got finished, I owed them $10,000.
Yeah, we had this was 15 years ago or so. Jerry Schneiderman, my old one of my best friends, and he and I had this little business in New York called Langley St. Clair Instrumentation Systems. It was a mail order business selling computer parts in the early days of computers, you know.
Yeah.
And our bookkeeper forgot to file one of the things with the state of New York, you know, one of the quarterly things.
Oh,
and a year and a half later, I'm down in Georgia, and they come down and they slap me with a $25,000 garnishment. And this is because, the whole bit. I mean, I'm facing going to jail. They're nailing things. They're trying to stop my housing mortgage payments, and all because Paul forgot to file a $310 deposit for withholding taxes or something.
That's why they're not going to change it though, because they're benefiting from it.
Well, I don't think so.
It's part of it. Hey, Tom, when they charge you that amount of money, that amount of interest on the money, and if they owe you money.
I get all that, Ed, but I really don't think that the Republicans are lined up on the side of the IRS and the Democrats are lined up against. This has to do with the credit card companies and the banks. That's really what it's all about. You're right. We have a problem with the IRS and we need to deal with it, but we need to, you know, that's a separate thing. I got to move on. Ed, thanks for the call. It's an important point you raise and a good one. It's worth ranting about. But anyhow, Jim in Illinois on the line. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's Tim in Illinois.
Oh, Tim, I'm sorry. Needing to strengthen my glasses here. Hey, Tim.
Just in case someone out there has an delusion about Barack Obama, he also voted against the limit of interest to 30%.
Oh, he did. I'm not showing that here.
Yeah, I'm looking at the congressional record right now.
Oh, that's interesting. Let me go back and find it here. 30%, let's see. 19 Democrats voted against this. That was the one that most of the Democrats voted against it, including Kerry and Obama.
Yeah, along with Kerry.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's what's with these guys? I mean, when are they going to start saying, gee, I'm here to serve the people, instead of, who was the last lobbyist who knocked on the door? I mean, part of the problem...
I really rant to Obama, and I don't get anything back but a form letter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, welcome to the club. I mean, it's
no,
but keep ranting nonetheless.
Will keep ranting.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Tim. I appreciate it. Good on you. That's what it takes to create a democracy, and it really and truly does. Is that we have to be active, and even if you get a form letter, you keep going at it. And, you know, part of the problem in the defense of these guys is that the system is broken, and that needs to be fixed, too. I'm Tom Hartman. Thanks for being with me today. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.